Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this Memorial Day with Philip Butler, a former naval light attack carrier pilot who, in 1965, was shot down over North Vietnam and spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. A highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts, joins us to discuss how veterans feel about their bone spur president trashing Phil Butler's fellow POW, John McCain. Then, with the diplomatic back and forth between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump, we will speak with Ellen Barfield, the National Vice President of Veterans for Peace and a U.S. veteran. She served with the U.S. military in South Korea, and we will discuss the impact a war in Korea would have on the inhabitants of the peninsula and her efforts to organize a series of Memorial Day events at the Washington Mall displaying the human costs of war. Then finally, we will speak with Michael Clare, the 5-College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College, about his article at Tom Dispatch, "Donald Trump is Driving Us on a Road to Hell in the Middle East." We will discuss the news from the New York Times that the U.S. Army Special Forces secretly aided the Saudi Arabian military against the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen, and the growing signs that the war hawks Netanyahu, Mohammed bin Salman, and John Bolton are moving the Trump administration closer to a third Gulf War. And on this Memorial Day, we are joined by Philip Butler, a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. And he completed his naval career in 1981 as a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and today is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Philip Butler.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be back on your program. I always appreciate your invitation.
Well, thank you, Phil. And on this Memorial Day, I know you've known John McCain for a long time, and I think you were at Annapolis together, weren't you?
Yes, we were. We were actually in the same company and lived across the passageway from him with over 3,000 midshipmen at the time. I guess life is stranger than fiction. John lived across the hall from me. He was a first classman, senior, at the same time that I was a plebe or freshman.
Well, I bring it up because lately a White House aide insulted John McCain and basically dismissed him, saying, "Why should we care about what he says? He'll be dead soon." And the extraordinary thing is that the White House, instead of firing that aide, they did a witch hunt to find out who the leaker was. And it sort of leads you to this extraordinary situation that we have where the President of the United States has insulted John McCain. And I believe that John McCain is held in much higher esteem than Trump is across the country. So do you think that's going to affect veterans the way the president, the commander-in-chief, has been so dismissive and insulting towards a war hero?
I don't know. I don't speak for veterans. I speak for myself. But I think it's pretty disgusting coming from what I and all my friends, including my Republican friends, refer to as the bone spur president. He's disgusting. But that person in his staff that said, "Why should we care?" was being perfectly honest, because that's absolutely true. Why should they care? They don't care. They could care less about John McCain or anybody else who's not a Trumpster. They just don't care about anything. They don't care about our country. They don't care about the Constitution, what little they know of it. They don't care about the rule of law. They don't care about all Americans, who the majority of whom think on a different line than they do. So, yeah, why should they care? Absolutely. That staffer was should get an award for honesty.
Well, when you refer to Trump as the bone spur president, you're referring to the fact that he got deferments during the Vietnam War for...
Yeah, right. Exactly. There we go.
Bone spurs. And he also, on the Howard Stern program, he said his Vietnam was getting venereal disease from all of the Playmate bunnies, I guess.
Well, I guess so. Bad choice, bad behavior, failure to use proper precautions or something. I don't know.
But how could we have no idea.
It's all disgusting to me though, because it's so degrading to our presidency and our nation and our rule of law. Everything is just being dismantled as we watch it in our eyes here. The law is being dismantled, and you know, Ian, I wanted to say something as I sit here, maybe just slightly off the subject, but I just wanted to say that regarding books that are out, you know, that listeners, people might be interested in. I started writing my book 10 years ago, and 2 years later, I had it completed. And these books that are coming out now, they just pop them out. I don't know how these guys do it, but I've got a stack of them here next to my chair to read. You know, I'm looking at it. My wife just handed me Ronan Farrow's War on Peace, which is a fabulous book. And James Comey has got A Higher Loyalty, and Clapper's book just came out. And Madeleine Albright's book on fascism. I mean, all of these just really important books, but they come out so fast, and I don't know how these people can bang these things out so quickly. They must have other writers to help them that I didn't have, or they know more about speed writing than I did. They're coming out faster than I could read one of them, but I'm trying in order to keep up. But I just want everybody to know that there's some just excellent, outstanding, you know, testaments to what is going on in our world in these books that people should get. And even if you have to stack them up next to your chair and read them in their time, keep them in your library, because they're going to prove prescient with what's happening in our country with this president and this Congress.
Well, Phil, I could add to your list there, because we're in our public radio fund drive, and every day I come up with a new book, or at least I try to, that's relevant to our audience and to the political moment we're in. There's an extraordinary book by the Yale historian Timothy Snyder called The Road to Road to Unfreedom. And then there's another book on called Trump Russia by the investigative reporter with the Associated Press, Seth Hettner. Both of those I highly recommend. And
Ian, how do I keep up? Well, I used to be a fast reader. Maybe I'm not so quick anymore. But
well, I have the same problem. I have to not only have to keep up, I got to read these books, and then I got to interview the authors and make sense.
you're amazing.
So, just again, I'm speaking with Phil Butler, a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy, a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. And he completed his naval career in 1981 as a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and today is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. Now, peace is looking pretty distant and receding into the dark, gathering storm of war clouds, with the possibility of going to war against Iran, having pulled out of the peace deal with Iran, or at least the nuclear deal with Iran, and now Trump on Thursday pulled out of the talks with the North Koreans. And then in a photo op on the same day, on last Thursday, Trump went on about how, in his letter, he talked about how we have bigger nuclear weapons than you do, little Kim. And then he went on about the idea that we're the most powerful nation in the world, and we're spending $700 billion on our military, and next year we're going to spend $716 billion, as though money equaled power and strength. Now, I suppose, coming from the world of wannabe billionaires, that's the way he sees the world.
Yeah, I don't know how he expects to fight everybody in the world. You haven't mentioned the two, probably, in my opinion, right now, the most important antagonists. Well, one little area of contention is the area between the Iranians in Syria and the Hezbollah and the Israelis. You know, he was so hot to jump in the middle of that and get our embassy in Jerusalem, which was really a dumb thing to do, to just up the heat in that area. But the two things, it's like he said, these things are like somebody rattling keys to distract your attention. But then there's the Russians are playing in the North Atlantic, doing really dangerous stuff with their overflights and their aircraft, and testing us to see if we will support NATO and the Balkan countries in that area. And the Chinese are trying to take over the Pacific Ocean by building islands and runways, and now they're bringing missiles into those man-made islands in the Pacific Ocean because they want to block off the Pacific, which would be disastrous for all of our allies in that area. So those are big time things that are going on, and Trump isn't paying attention to any of that stuff. But I can't for the life of me figure out why he changes his ideas are so different between North Korea and Iran. With North Korea, he wants to use diplomacy and wants to talk with On and Kim Jong-un, and yet with Iran, he wants to tear up the diplomatic treaty that we had with him. It's bizarre. It's like there's no strategy, there's no thought, there's no overall plan for anything he does. He just thrashes out all over the place and creates dissension all over the world. Even with our own allies, he creates dissension.
Right, but you've just described the Russians' military buildup and their intimidation of the Baltic states to test U.S. resolve about Article 5 of the NATO treaty. And we know that Trump himself was always reluctant to invoke and support Article 5 of the NATO treaty, which upset the NATO allies. So, and then you got the Chinese, as you say, building these man-made islands. They actually landed some bombers on them recently. That would indicate to me that Putin and Xi Jinping are not afraid of our big, blustering, cowboy, tough guy, John Wayne, gunslinging president in the White House.
Yeah, I think he's that he is making us weaker. He blusters about all the strength and power and all these missiles that he has and everything, but everybody recognizes him as weak, as a charlatan, as a liar, and as one that doesn't hold up to his word. He says he's going to do something, and then he backs off. He says he's going to have, a big renegotiation of treaties with China, and then in the next instance, the Chinese stand up to it, but then he backs off and says, "Well, never mind. We're going to hold on. We're going to hold on this." So he makes himself and us look to be weak, and of course we are weak when we don't have allies that can support us around the world, and we don't have good diplomacy. He's absolutely dismantled our diplomatic corps. It's just a shell of what it was before he came into office.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, you mentioned that your Republican friends refer to Donald Trump as the bone spur president. Do you think that the military community in this country could rise up against him? I mean, he's in league with Putin. Putin put him in there. That's what James Clapper, one of the books you mentioned, he came to that conclusion that Trump was actually put over the top and he won the election because of Putin. That's an extraordinary thing to get your head around in the first place. But the idea that we're trapped between a criminal kleptocrat in the Kremlin and a criminal kleptocrat in the Oval Office, and Trump is at war with the law and he's at war with truth, and we are in a very dangerous moment, and I don't see who's going to save us. I don't know that the Democrats are going to save us. The Republicans are completely disgusting. They're going along with the destruction of this country. What's left? The deep state?
I don't know how bad this has to get. I don't know how low we have to sink. Every day I think we're at the bottom of this thing. I have to have faith that our constitutional system will eventually override and come out of this as yet another test in our republic. But it's really looking frightening. This guy just has the ability, it seems, to dismantle all the institutions that go to make up our republic and our way of life and our constitution. The Republicans do seem to be hopeless, and yet I play golf on occasion with a number of these guys who were Republicans, who incidentally most of them did not ever vote for Trump, but they're kind of the old style Republicans. They're guys that are my age. I'm going to be 80 this year, and these guys are guys in their 70s and 80s. So, you know, their thinking is like 40s and 50s, I guess, and 60s Republicans, more conservative, but issues that, you know, we can discuss and talk about after we play golf and sit at lunch and have a beer, and we can talk about all this stuff. But it's certainly not the Trump toadies and gutless idiots that are call themselves Republicans in the House of Representatives, for example. It's just disgusting. I can only hope, good heavens, I can only hope that at least the Democrats will have a majority after the 2018 election. So, though, like you say, I don't have a whole lot of faith in the Democrats either, but at least I have a whole lot more faith with Democrats than I do the Republicans that are currently in office in Congress.
Well, Phil Butler, I thank you very much for joining us today on this Memorial Day.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure and an honor to be able to talk with you.
Well, thank you, Phil. And again, Phil Butler is a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. And he completed his naval career in 1981 as a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. And today is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with a Veterans for Peace who is organizing Memorial Day events at the Washington Mall.
I've got an angel. She doesn't wear any wings. She wears a heart that can melt my own. She wears a smile that can make me wanna sing. She gives me presents.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us on this Memorial Day is Helen Barfield, a longtime activist with Veterans for Peace, who was deployed with the U.S. military in Korea. She is helping organize a series of events at the Mall in D.C. today, displaying the human cost of war on Memorial Day. Welcome to Background Briefing, Helen Barfield.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
And Helen, just to go back to last Thursday when President Trump caught everybody by surprise and pulled out of the planned summit in Singapore on June the 12th with Kim Jong-un, North Korean leader. It looks as though, I mean, you could probably make this case that John Bolton, his national security advisor, sabotaged it initially by bringing up the so-called Libya model as a way for North Korea to disarm. And the North Koreans, of course, thinking about what happened to Gaddafi, felt that that was pretty much a threat, if you will. And then later,
I would call it an extreme threat. Yes.
Right. Well, but then, in addition to that, Mike Pence, the vice president, when asked about the Libyan model, says, well, yes, if the North Koreans don't make a deal, they could end up like Gaddafi, which then prompted the North Koreans to say that Mike Pence is a political dummy. And then Trump allegedly used as an excuse, that insult as an excuse to cancel the meeting. But just to touch on the broader landscape here, do you think that the neocons and Vice President Pence sabotaged this, or did something else happen?
It's hard to know. I agree with your comment about Trump is government by stunt. And the people he puts in place behave predictably, maybe not for him, but for some of the rest of us. You say it was a total surprise that Trump pulled out. I'm not really very surprised. That's what he does, is throw temper tantrums. And yes, so did the North Korean leaders, and have for quite a while. So here we have two toddlers bashing each other over the head. I'm not terribly surprised. And I kind of would rather Trump stayed out of it and let the two Korean leaders, perhaps out of fear of what Trump might do, perhaps out of finally knocking their heads like that old V8 commercial, wow, I could have talked with my cohort on the other side of the country, or the, you know, it was one country for a very long time until the Western leaders got involved. So we could sit down and work this out together, and let's not invite Trump. I don't blame them for feeling that way if they do. I feel that way. So I'm not surprised Trump has done what he's done, and it may be a better thing, actually.
Well, but I'm not very reassured. You talk about two toddlers, Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump, and that's, I think, a very apt description. But these are toddlers with nuclear weapons.
Absolutely. It's terrifying. I'm not saying I'm not afraid. I am. But I think it's more likely that the two Korean leaders can work it out than that Trump could help in any way. So, you know, this gave him his tweetable moment, and he'll move on to something else, I hope. It's, yes, John Bolton is a terrifying figure and has been for a long time. These terrible government under leaders keep coming back. It's awful and distressing. And Pence is, yeah, not very smart in his foreign policy estimates. So it's more embarrassment for this country. Yes, I'm very embarrassed to be a citizen of this country. The rest of the world is rolling their eyes, but also afraid because, yes, we've got massive numbers of weapons. North Korea has a few. The U.S. has many. So all this blather about how dangerous North Korea is, yeah, if you poke a hyena, they can be dangerous, but the U.S. is massively more dangerous.
Well, but this is the what Donald Trump stressed in his address last Thursday, explaining why he pulled out of the nuclear talks or the disarmament talks with North Korea. He went on to talk about how powerful our military is, and he equated our military power, saying he's fixed it, he's made us more powerful than ever. But he equated U.S. military power with how much money we're spending. He said, you know, we're spending $700 billion on the military, and next year we're going to spend $716 billion. I mean, it's an extraordinary, to equate military power. And in fact, without the real full spectrum of national security, because our national security has other dimensions than military power, economic power, cultural power, and moral power. Not that there's much of that left.
No, not much. Absolutely. And it would be much better for us and for the world if our leaders would stop thinking every nail needs a hammer. That is more and more the only way we interact with the world, and it's awful, and it takes away from human needs in this country. I am, among other things, participating in the Poor People's Campaign, this 40-day campaign, to point out that poverty, racism, militarism, and environmental devastation are all deeply interconnected, and military threats to the rest of the world, spending massive amounts of money to beef up an already enormous military, which has somewhere around 1,000 bases in over 150 countries around the world. I mean, come on. Isn't that enough? Isn't that way too much already? Yes, it is atrocious and embarrassing and frightening behavior, definitely. And my organization, Veterans for Peace, one of my organizations, is going to be doing a lot of things over the Memorial Day weekend, in small ways, because we're not a big organization, but we've been doing some really moving events in D.C. around Memorial Day for several years now, and we'll be doing them again today.
So, again, I'm speaking with Ellen Barfield, a longtime activist with Veterans for Peace, who was deployed with the U.S. military in Korea. She is helping organize a series of events at the Mall in Washington, D.C. today, displaying the human costs of war on Memorial Day. So I wonder, though, how we're going to get out of this predicament, because the former head of U.S. intelligence, General Clapper, just recently said that, in effect, Putin and the Russians put this guy, Trump, in the Oval Office. He made no bones about it. And I think you have to assume that since he was a director of national intelligence in a long-time military and intelligence career on a very, you know, nonpartisan basis, like most military people, I have to believe what he's saying. And so I feel like we are caught between a criminal kleptocrat in the Kremlin and a criminal kleptocrat in the Oval Office. And Trump is working overtime. He's fighting both against truth and against the law. He's trying to gin up this whole campaign on Fox News, calling it Spygate. We've never had a situation where the investigated is able to investigate the investigators. So he's turned the table, and he's blaming all of his woes on the deep state. Well, ironically, since I don't have a lot of faith in the Democrats, and I'm disgusted by the Republicans for enabling this criminal to behave the way he is and ruin this country, all that's left is the deep state to get rid of him. I mean, well, except for the people. So you tell me what you think.
Well, yes. I don't want the deep state in charge any more than I want Trump in charge. They're both very dangerous. So, yes, it's the people. And, you know, that's been my life's work for 30 years and will continue to be as long as I'm still around, is to try to inspire the people to rise up. And referring back to the Poor People's Campaign, that's what it's trying to do, too, to link the various threats we face and point out how connected they are. The massive U.S. military threats and spending are terrible for the world, terrible for U.S. citizens, terrible especially for oppressed and deprived U.S. citizens, poor people, African Americans, and other people of color, LGBT folks, women, you know, it goes on and on. Anyone who's been disadvantaged is more disadvantaged by every worsening we have. And I have never believed that things had to bottom out before, or, you know, wanted that to happen so that people would rise up. But I got to say, it seems perhaps that is what's happening. Fear and trembling about Trump being in the White House seems to have inspired a lot of people. I don't know if it'll be enough. We never know if it'll be enough. But more and more people are recognizing they have to hit the streets, they have to get more active, they have to speak out more. And that's where we need to go. So in our very small way, Veterans for Peace will be trying to point out the horrendous causes of war and show a different way, show that peace, sitting down and talking things out instead of always going to the military option, is the way we have to go, and if it will never happen unless the citizens demand it. Yes, Trump is increasing military spending even more, but it's not as if it was low before. It's always been extremely high, and it's getting even higher.
Well, what I'm afraid of, among a lot that we've been discussing already, Ellen Barfield, I find that the scary notion of a weak strong man. And that's the case of Kim Jong-un. You know, he presides over a decrepit country, but they've got nuclear weapons. And by the way, he was worried about whether his plane could fly all the way to Singapore. And he was worried about security in Singapore and whether there'd be a coup against him while he was away, out of town, etc. I mean, this is the reality of this weak strong man. But we also have a weak strong man in Donald Trump. He's obviously insecure, infantile, and the letter that he sent last week to the North Koreans was like, in fact, Wendy Sherman, one of the negotiators on the Iran deal, said it was like, a 13-year-old at overnight camp breaking up with his best friend and calling his mother to let him come home.
Yes, yes. You know, whatever childish accusations we can make about Trump, I think, are very true, and Kim Jong-un also. As I said, it's like two toddlers. I wouldn't even say 13 years old. And that makes it very frightening. But again, I want to say that the massively too big U.S. military is not something Trump invented. He's increasing it, yes, but he's only increasing something that was already there under both Democrats and Republicans. I very appreciated your saying you don't have any faith in the Democrats, nor do I. The Republicans are horrendous, but the Democrats are not much better. They are all in the thrall of the military-industrial complex, and it behooves the arms merchants to keep tensions high, to keep selling equipment, to keep bringing in massive amounts of money from the U.S. taxpayers. That is a grotesque situation, and the only way it's going to change is if the people demand it.
Well, but how do you get to that point? I mean, you talked about how more and more people are going to be politically motivated and take to the streets because of the dangerous nature of the moment and the fact that our president is at war with the rule of law in this country and is undermining democracy. I don't think we've ever had something quite as dire as that. But at its heart, though, I think the real issue is how do we get across to the American people the absurdity of all of our resources or the lion's share of our resources going to the military in the sense that we are improving the redundancy of death at the expense of the quality of life.
Oh, very nice line, improving the redundancy of death at the expense of the quality of life. Yes, exactly. As if we didn't already have the ability to destroy at least higher life on Earth many times over with our nuclear weapons. Even with just our conventional weapons, we could go a long ways down that road if we launched into yet another massive boots-on-the-ground shooting war. We have all these undeclared drone wars going on all over the place, but mostly people ignore those because they're kind of under the radar. Not that they're not happening, not that they're not provocative and dangerous, but Trump seems even more inclined to at least threaten, maybe launch into World War III, basically. Terrifying. How to turn it back? Honey, if I knew, I'd have done it long ago. But I know for sure that whatever we can do as activists, whatever we can do to inspire formerly disempowered or lazy or not paying attention citizens to speak out as loudly as they can, as often as they can, call their elected officials, of course, sit in their offices, don't let them ignore that they've got to change things, stop funding wars, put back what Trump has already taken away. The Veterans Administration, where I get my health care, is on the auction block right now. You know, just on and on. Our schools are in disrepair. Our police are more and more militarized with surplus military equipment. Just on and on, all the terrible human deficits of our people in the U.S. And if we don't rise up, for sure it won't change. I don't know if rising up will change it, but for sure it won't unless. Rise up in every way we can. Speak to our neighbors, speak to our elected officials, sign petitions, hit the streets with banners, blockade. Elected officials' offices until they do the right thing. Civil resistance actions. I have dear friends who recently went into the submarine base at Kings Bay, Georgia, for what's called a plowshares action, referring to the Bible verse about beating swords into plowshares, that we must turn away from militarism and more weapons and sit down and work it out as reasonable people.
Well, just to touch on, you mentioning the VA, where you, as a veteran, Alan Barfield, you get your medical treatment. The Koch brothers' Front Concerned Veterans of America are behind this effort to privatize the VA.
That's right.
And people should be aware that this is just an absolute raid on the Treasury to basically turn over this very... They've been pumping all this propaganda about how screwed up the VA is, which is largely a lie. There have been some problems, obviously. But they're doing that because they don't want single payer, the American people, to figure out that single payer actually works. That's the real agenda, don't you think?
Oh, I absolutely do. The Veterans Administration is a socialized health care or single payer, if you will, yes. And it's far from perfect, mostly because it's pretty much never been fully funded, and so that everyone can't access it. Not every veteran is signed up with the VA. Sadly, that's a fact, and as far as I know, pretty much always has been, to varying percentages at various times. But the promises they make to veterans, and that's a big one, that you will have lifetime health care, it's a lie to a fairly large extent. And that's horrendous. But it's not because the VA is a bad organization. They do the best they can, and they are able to focus on particular needs that veterans have that the general civilian population don't have. And so destroying the VA, just throwing it into the regular medical market, would take away the tremendous advantages the VA has of the special knowledge and focus on particular veterans' problems. And it will, we, you know, veterans must object to that. Yes, the Koch brothers are able to pay for so-called grass tops, you know, things that appear to be grassroots and are actually highly paid for by rich people with an agenda.
Right.
That's what the Koch brothers have done in many arenas, and this is one of them. But, and, you know, Trump and gang are out to get Medicaid and Medicare and Social Security and the VA. Those are government policies, government programs that have worked pretty well for a long time, and there's a lot of money in them, of course, because they're expensive. Not enough money, but a lot of money. And so, of course, the rich people are going after those things. And we must say no. We absolutely must say no.
Well, just in closing, Ellen Barfield, since you are a veteran and you served with the U.S. military in Korea, I think the priorities in the way that we're dealing with the nuclear weapons as a focus with North Korea may be misplaced, because the real threat is the enormous conventional military force that the North Koreans have deployed just across the DMZ, their million-man army. Most of that army is deployed just across the DMZ. The artillery is in caves, in hardened bunkers, etc. And they have said, and everybody understands, that they could wipe out Seoul in a matter of an hour or so, turn it into a sea of fire, I think is what they've described it as. If you wipe out Seoul, you pretty much destroy a very successful and functioning country. So my sense is that we should have, from the beginning, been focused on conventional arms reductions. What do you think?
Absolutely. In fact, there was a time when U.S. troops in Korea, of which I was one back in 1980, long time ago, they were drawn down to a fairly large extent, and they've built back up again. Those numbers have fluctuated over time. And yes, it's true that North Korea has both a few nukes, that perhaps they could even get one or two of them to the U.S. mainland now with some missile development, but one or two, like I said. I mean, they have a handful. We have tens of thousands on hair trigger alert. Very different. But there are U.S. nuclear weapons in South Korea. There are U.S. nuclear weapons in submarines off the Koreas. And there are U.S. nuclear weapons all over the world that have the capability to converge on North Korea. So, and U.S. conventional forces in the tens of thousands of troops on the ground in South Korea, and again, Air Force and Navy and other troops in the Asia region that could be there in a heartbeat. So, yes, North Korea is a military threat, but what they are opposing is the massive U.S. presence in South Korea. And what they would particularly like to see end is the war games that the U.S. and South Korea are perpetrating all the time. They're very provocative. They fly into North Korean airspace. They sail into North Korean water. you know, there's all this mainstream media blather about how dangerous North Korea is. And yes, they're pretty militarized, but the U.S. is way more militarized and also way more threatening. So, again, we get back to the two toddlers threatening each other, except that they're threatening the whole world. Well, and, you know, we got to speak out however we can to object to it. Part of what Veterans for Peace will be doing today at the Korean War Memorial is congratulating the two Korean leaders for sitting down and hoping they can move farther toward an actual peace treaty. The Korean police action that was never a fully declared war back in the early 50s and has never had more than a ceasefire ever since. It needs to have a treaty, and the country needs to be reunited while families can still see each other that have been divided at the DMZ for lo these many years. People still want to see their relatives that they haven't seen in so long. And we need to, we as citizenry, we as veterans especially, need to push for those things and that the Korean leaders get it right. Perhaps their concern over Trump's craziness will help them finally sign a treaty. Let's hope so.
Well, Ellen Barfield, I thank you very much for joining us on this Memorial Day.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Ellen Barfield, who's a longtime activist with Veterans for Peace, who was deployed with the U.S. military in Korea. She is helping organize a series of events at the Mall in Washington, D.C. today, displaying the human costs of war on Memorial Day. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the Trump administration is moving us closer to a third Gulf War. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us on this Memorial Day is Michael Clare, a Fife College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Fife College Program on Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include American Arms Supermarket, World Security, Challenges for a New Century, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, Blood and Oil, and his most recent book is The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. And he has an article at The Nation, Donald Trump is driving us on a road to hell in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Clare.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
Well, thank you, Michael. And I think you could update your article by saying that Donald Trump is driving us on a road to hell in the Middle East and on the Korean Peninsula, given what happened last Thursday.
I fear that's the case. I think ever since John Bolton and Mike Pompeo joined the team at the White House, I feared that we're going to be headed down this path because they both have spoken before about their belief that these issues are best solved through the use of military force. So they've hinted as much, and they're doing everything they possibly can to sabotage a peaceful outcome to our issues with Iran and North Korea. And I think, therefore, we are headed on a path to war with either or both of those countries.
Well, but it was Bolton and Mike Pence who clearly sabotaged it by talking about the Libyan model. And when the North Koreans objected, Pence then doubled down by saying, well, the Libyan model does apply. If the North Koreans don't agree to the deal, Kim Jong-un could end up, implying that Kim Jong-un could end up like Gaddafi. I mean, that is a threat, is it not?
Absolutely. Absolutely, you're right. Mike Pence has contributed to this. But the ouster of Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State, as somebody who had favored a diplomatic solution to these situations, who had favored retention of the nuclear deal with Iran, who favored negotiations with North Korea, and replacing him and the National Security Advisor with these avowed hawks, signaled to me that the White House was intent on a path that would lead, as I say, lead to the possibility of war. And I'm really frightened at this moment that we're headed in that direction.
Well, one of the things that's extraordinary, I mean, Trump is clearly an ignoramus and an incompetent. And I call it government by stunt. He keeps whipsawing you all the time with these stunts, like pulling out of the North Korea talks, because he doesn't really know what he's doing. But the idea that this rank amateur can think that you tear up the Iran deal, and if you cancel the nuclear talks with North Korea, you can then come back and make a better deal. It's complete delusion.
That's a kind way of putting it. You're absolutely right. But I do fear that lurking behind all of this, there's a belief that Trump has had from the beginning that, oh, well, you know, he says the way he says it, well, he says, we'll see, or, you know, I think lurking behind all of this is his belief that, well, if negotiations don't work out the way we want them, well, we'll go to the next level and we'll blast them to cinders. And he talks that way all the time, and he has repeated that recently. I think that's the way he thinks. If he doesn't get his way one way, he'll get it another way through the use of force. And he has no hesitation about going in that direction, or at least that's the way it sounds to me. And now he has eliminated anybody in the White House who might think otherwise, like Rex Tillerson and others, and replaced them with people who support this fantasy.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Clare, a Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His latest book is The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. And he has an article at The Nation, Donald Trump is Driving Us on a Road to Hell in the Middle East. So on this Memorial Day, we, of course, observe the enormous sacrifices the United States has made in World War I, World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and the wars in the Middle East, which, of course, were by and large unnecessary and certainly counterproductive. But the idea that we could have a third Gulf War is just mind-boggling. But you seem to think, and I must say I share your concerns, that that is where we're heading. So what's your scenario for what's going on here? Because I see a very dangerous mix of Netanyahu pushing Trump, wanting us to fight his war for him against Iran. The same is true of MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. You've got Eric Prince with his mercenary army there in the Emirates. MBZ is a dangerous guy who's actually a mentor of MBS's. And you've got the Straits of Hormuz, where all that choke point with all the tankers going by and warships and the Iranian Revolutionary Guards with their little speedboats. Trump's already warned them, saying, don't you come too close to our beautiful warships. Anything could spark a wider war there. And you've also, on top of that, you've got these proxies of the Iranians, like the Houthis firing missiles at Saudi Arabia. And then you've also got the UAE and other proxies working in Yemen in a terrible, destructive war that is a crying shame in terms of the humanitarian outrages going on there.
Yes, all that you say is part of this larger picture that I think is leading us to the possibility of a conflict with Iran. What I distinguish what's happening now from what I call a third Gulf War is the conflict's now underway, and we have to admit, as you say, that these are bloody affairs in Yemen and the continuing fighting in Syria and in Libya and elsewhere, Afghanistan. But in all of those conflicts, the adversaries that the United States faces are guerrillas, insurgents, and the like. If we go to war with Iran, which I think is what John Bolton would like to see happen in the not-too-distant future, we're talking about a state versus another state kind of a war, as was the case in the first Gulf War in 1991 and the second Gulf War, the 2003 invasion of Iraq. In that case of a war with Iran, we're talking about army versus army with large-scale operations, many, many planes and ships and missiles engaged in a risk of a very high level of intensity of conflict, of many casualties spread all across the Middle East. Because, as you say, Ian, there are these so-called proxy forces in Yemen, in Lebanon, in Syria, Iraq, elsewhere that would enter into the fray. So this would be a region-wide conflict fought at a very high level by advanced military forces on both sides. So the risk of escalation and large-scale casualties would be very great.
But in the meantime, both Iran and Saudi Arabia are essentially fighting a war through their proxies, which is destroying Yemen and has already destroyed Syria.
Yes, and but I think we should be a little bit careful about using that term. The Houthis are an autonomous, independent group with their own history that have accepted assistance from Iran. It's clear. But I think by calling them proxies of Iran, that feeds into the propaganda coming out of the White House, and as you say, Netanyahu, and as you say, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, all of whom want to picture what's happening in the Middle East as a product of Iranian influence and Iranian proxies. The Houthis are not proxies of the Iranians in quite the same way that the coalition forces, so-called Saudi Arabia and the UAE, are fighting in Yemen. That's an invasion. That's an intervention by a foreign power in a sovereign country of Yemen. The Houthis are an autonomous, independent group who originated there, who have long been suffered at the hands of government authorities. So they have accepted Iranian aid, but I wouldn't call them proxies. I think we're seeing an attempt to portray Iran as a monster octopus controlling all these groups. Hezbollah is another example, Hamas. So we got to be careful.
Well, that's certainly a point well taken. But on the other hand, I think the great tragedy of the moment, and I must say that the speech that Mike Pompeo made recently about Iran was completely delusional. But the reality in Iran is that the young, the educated, the women, the majority, except for the people in the country, it's kind of like the blue state, red state divide here, the urban educated people just loathe this government. It's a bunch of crooked mullahs who are bleeding the country dry. And then on top of that, the budget was published a little while back that outraged the people. They realized how much money the theocrats were stealing and how much money was being wasted on supporting Hezbollah and Hamas, and Iranians were demonstrating in the street saying, no more aid for the Palestinians, how about us? And the economy is on its knees, inflation is out of control. The promise that they made through this nuclear deal of opening up hasn't happened. And frankly, I don't know that anybody wants to do business with Iran as long as you could be captured and jailed by the IRGC. The Chinese, of course, are doing business hand over fist with them. And as the U.S. pulls out, Russia and China will have more influence in that part of the world, particularly in Iran. So this is, to my mind, the real tragedy is that Iran is ripe for regime change, but it has to happen from within. And the minute that the U.S., the Israelis and the Saudis gin up a war, the Iranians will rally around the flag and support this dreadful government of mullahs.
I think you spoke very well to this point about the fact that the masses of the Iranians, or most of them anyway, the more and more of the population is young, youthful. They want to have access to the West. They want to have opportunities for economic advancement and so on. I think you're absolutely right about that. They'd like to get rid of this regime, and they would like to be able to travel to the United States and to the West and so on. So you're right about that. You're also equally right that if the U.S. attacks, Israel attacks, they will rally around the flag. All of that is true. I just think it's dangerous to demonize the Iranians at a time when there are these powerful forces in the White House, in Saudi Arabia, and Israel and elsewhere that are gearing us up to go to war with Iran. Iran is a large country. You know, I forget how many millions of people, but it's a big country, and it's going to defend itself, and it would be a horror if we go to war with Iran. So I just argue against anything that would demonize Iran at this moment. I don't support what they're doing. They did, however, agree to a nuclear agreement with the United States. They've abided by that agreement scrupulously from all that we know. They've done everything that we've asked them to do. And now Donald Trump is torn up the deal, saying that they're not in compliance with it. But it's absolutely clear that they have been in compliance with the deal, including the mullahs, even though they weren't happy with it. So in this case, the rogue state is the United States of America, not the Iranians. And I hope that the Europeans that argued against tearing up the deal will stand with the Iranians in trying to preserve that deal. It was a good deal for us because it prevented Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons.
Well, Michael Clare, I thank you very much for joining us on this Memorial Day.
It's been my pleasure. These are difficult issues, and we all need to grapple as best we can with them. Thank you, Ian, for taking this up.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Clare, Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include American Arms Supermarket, World Security, Challenges for a New Century, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, Blood and Oil, and most recently, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. And he has an article at The Nation, Donald Trump is Driving Us on a Road to Hell in the Middle East. This has been a special Memorial Day edition of Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producers Ricky Herrera, Kathleen Ash, and Alejandra Larivalat. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.